You're listening to Now I've Heard Everything, interviews from the 80s, 90s, and 2000s with voices from the past.
I don't want to let everybody think that all escort services are run like this. One of the things that I tried to do was to make it fun and to make it glamorous and to give the girls an opportunity to have a good time.
Former Mayflower Madam Sydney Biddle Barrows. Today on Now I've Heard Everything, I'm Bill Thompson. Well, as public scandals go, this one might seem kind of benign by today's rather low bar, but in 1984, it was kind of big news when authorities in New York City broke up a very high-priced escort service that had some very powerful clients. It was run by a woman named Sydney Biddle Barrows. Now, when a reporter for the New York Post did a little digging and found that the 32-year-old Barrows was actually a member of Philadelphia's elite Biddle family, and in fact was a direct descendant of the original Mayflower settlers, he dubbed her the Mayflower Madam, and the name stuck. Well, within a couple of years of her company being shut down and her legal troubles, Sydney Biddle Barrows wrote a book called Mayflower Madam, and that's when I first met her. So here now, from 1986, Mayflower Madam Sydney Biddle Barrows.
Why did you do this? Why did you get into this?
Well, I was working in the fashion industry, and my new boss was on the take, and it took me a long time to figure it out, but I finally did, and she needed my cooperation, and I refused, so she fired me. Well, I had another girlfriend who was also on unemployment, and sort of between looking for jobs, we'd hang out together, and one day I went over to her place, and she was unpacking a brand new stereo. And I looked at her and I said, gee, you know, where'd you get the money for that? And she hemmed and hawed. And I said, so come on, did it fall off the back of a truck or what? You can tell me. And she said, well, she said, if you swear you won't tell anyone. I said, I promise. She said, I answer the phones for an escort service. And I said, what's an escort service? And she said, well, I sit in this office and these guys call up and they tell me the kind of girl they'd like to see. I match them up with somebody and I send her over there. And I said, no kidding. How much do these girls get paid? She said, $125 an hour. And I said, no kidding. And then I said, they don't have to sleep with these guys, do they? And she said, well, Sydney, what do you expect for $125? I said, no kidding. I mean, I was just blown away. And I said, well, how much do you make answering the phones? She said, $50 a night, off the books, too. And, you know, back in 1978, $50 off the books was a lot of money. So I said, but I think any unemployed person at that point would have said, gee, if they ever have an opening for the phones, let me know. She said, sure. You know, we started talking about other things. Well, a few weeks later, she called me up and she said, remember that escort service I was telling you about? I said, yeah. She said, well, one of the girls who answers the phone is going to be leaving. Are you still interested in the job? Well, all of a sudden I had cold feet. Well, I don't think so. I mean, I was afraid of being arrested. I was afraid of the mafia. I was just afraid. And she said, come on. She said, he's been in business for like 10 years. Nothing's ever happened to him. It can't hurt you to go over and talk to the guy. And I thought, yeah. Can't hurt me to go over and talk to the guy. So I went over and I talked to him, and quite frankly, I didn't really like him very much, but he had been there for a long time, and, you know, he explained to me how he operated so that they couldn't get arrested, and he assured me there was no mafia or anything involved. I met a number of the girls while I was up there, and they all seemed very nice, and the clients on the speakerphone certainly sounded like gentlemen, and I thought, for $50, I could use the money. I'll try it. So, that's what I started doing. I started answering the phones. Well, the problem was that Eddie ran the business so badly. I come from a merchandising background, and Eddie was just doing it all wrong. I mean, Lucy and I were second-guessing him at every step. He should have done this. We would have done that. And finally, one day, we looked at each other, and we said, you know, we're at least as smart as he is. We're definitely brighter than he is. Why don't we try it? So we got ourselves all geared up and, you know, said, yeah, you know, we could be the best. We could be this. We could be that. And we went out and we did it. So I just, you know, a lot of people say, well, gee, Sydney, you know, didn't you think about it? I think the answer to that is I really didn't think about it. I was so excited about doing it. It was such a challenge that I didn't think about it. And I think I didn't think about it because I knew if I did, I knew I wouldn't do it. And I wanted to do it. I was all geared up and excited to do it. And I know if I thought about it, I would think better of it. So I just went ahead and did it. Now, this was in May of 1979. And all of a sudden in January of 1980, when income tax time came around, we looked at each other and we said, what are we going to tell the IRS? You know, then we looked at each other and we said, gee, you know, there are a lot of people out there who would consider that what we're doing is illegal. We better clean our act up. So we went to a lawyer and sort of got some legal advice, and we found an ex-vice squad sergeant who was at that time working as a private detective, and we got some information from him. And that's when we really sort of started protecting ourselves. But that's really how I got going.
So many of our listeners, though, will say, you've got such business acumen. You knew how to run this thing so perfectly. You could have channeled your energies into so many other things. If you, just so many more respectable things, they'll say.
That's true. They're absolutely right. But the thing is, you know how they say being in the right place at the right time? I just happened to be in that place at that time. I wasn't doing anything else. It was very exciting and very challenging to do something that not only had no one ever done before, but to be the best in your field. And I certainly agree with people. Yes, I could have done something different, and I probably should have, but I didn't. And, you know, I don't know what else to say about that.
How did you recruit your young ladies? Was it difficult, first of all, to find good applicants?
No, it wasn't at all. We just put an ad in the Help Wanted section of the Village Voice.
People, again, will think, this is not a respectable business. Nice girls don't apply for jobs like this.
Well, you know, it all depends on your version of nice girls. There are a lot of girls out there who are doing things people don't consider nice. There are girls out there who go dancing, which a lot of people don't consider nice. There are a lot of girls out there who have premarital sex, which a lot of people don't consider nice. There's a lot of girls out there who live with their boyfriends before they get married. A lot of people don't like that either. So this is just yet another sort of personal moral issue, a personal privacy issue that these young ladies had sat down, thought about, and said, I think it's okay for me to do. It might not be okay for you to do, but I think it's okay for me. You know, and a lot of people also say to me, well, gee, Sydney, you know, don't you feel bad exploiting these girls? Don't you feel badly that you led them into this business? And my answer to them always is that these girls had already decided that they were going to be in this business. At this point, it was primarily a matter of for whom were they going to work. And I really felt that given the eddies of this world out there, that I really gave them the best alternative. You know, the way I ran the agency was very safe, very health conscious, helped them maintain their dignity. It was very fair. It was very honest.
In other words, if not you, maybe some pimp in a pink Cadillac?
Well, no, another Eddie. They would have gone to someone like Eddie. Or worse, Eddie ran one of the better businesses of that sort in New York. And it was a far cry from ours. So I don't feel I let anyone down the road of sin. I feel they were already on their way.
After this short break, Sydney Biddle Barrows on making it look more glamorous and fun than it really was.
Start your day with Now I've Heard Everything.
We post new episodes every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 5 o'clock a.m. Eastern Time.
Subscribe now so you'll have something fresh to listen to and get your day going.
Now back to my 1986 interview with Sydney Biddle Barrows.
Now, you put an ad in the Village Voice and in another publication, too, as I recall.
Show business, yes.
And you advertise you're an escort service, you want young ladies. Now, the New York Vice cops aren't stupid. They must see the ads. Weren't you afraid that there were going to be any undercover cops among these women who applied?
No, because there's a tacit sort of agreement among the New York Vice Squad cops that they just don't bother consenting adults who do things in private. The things that the Vice Squad in New York is the most concerned with are the girls on the street. You know, the things that people call up and say, these girls are back on my corner again, get rid of them. You know, they know what crime is and they know what bad stuff is. Honey, when you're in New York, you know, crime there is the worst. The last thing they're going to bother with is a bunch of high class call girls. They just couldn't care less.
The book reads so, well, so wholesome and so fun, and I think there might be some people who think you're painting it a little bit too rosy.
Well, I'm not, I don't want to let everybody think that all escort services are run like this. One of the things that I tried to do was to make it fun and to make it glamorous and you know, to give the girls an opportunity to have a good time. I think that most other agencies aren't run like this. I think that a girl who's out there looking to do this kind of thing will find out in about 5 minutes that it would be very, very difficult, if not impossible, for her to have as fun and as glamorous an experience as this was. I think this is an isolated incident.
Do you think you could have done this in any city besides New York? Could you have done it in Washington?
I used to get calls all the time from clients in Washington saying, don't you know anybody down here? There have to be people like me in Washington. There just have to be. I mean, considering the kind of city it is, the number of diplomats, the number of politicians.
So but you don't know any?
I never knew anybody in Washington. I knew people in Boston, in L.A., in San Francisco, Houston, Dallas, Chicago. I never knew anyone in Washington.
I agree.
I wish I had. I could have sent them huge amounts of business.
I agree. There must be somebody here
in
town. There must be. too much business going untapped if there isn't. Do you think you've been treated fairly by the media since your story broke?
I really do. Now, when there's fairly and there's truthfully, I don't feel that the media has always been quite truthful when it comes to me, but that the untrue things that they print have been very flattering. So, you know, it's a hard call.
Celebrities who are, or people who are suddenly thrust into being celebrities seem to go in the normal cycle of the story breaks and suddenly they're canonized when everybody is fascinated with the story. And then suddenly, As reporters rush to beat each other with the grimy details, suddenly the distortions come out, the bad press, as it were. Have you experienced that? Did you notice that at all?
I have never gotten bad press. I really haven't. See, fortunately for me, there are no grimy, seedy stories to uncover. You know, I have no skeletons in my closet. You know, everything that I've been telling everybody really is the absolute truth. And I think that with all of the 176 girls listed in the back of the book that worked for me, the fact that not one of them has ever come forward, even anonymously, the fact that not one client has ever come forward, even anonymously, I think goes to back up the fact that, you know, everything in that book is really honestly true. I think that's why the press hasn't done any dirt to me. They can't find any.
But I'm sure that every reporter in New York, especially for the Post, would probably like to find out if the client list still exists.
Oh, it does. The district attorney has all seven little black, well, they weren't all black. They were each one a different color according to part of the alphabet they were. But no, they're all sitting down in the district attorney's office, and I'd love to know who has access to them because it terrifies me that that might come out sometime.
I'm wondering, too, because they lose far less valuable things like pounds of cocaine.
That's
all
right.
The time.
All this hair. I know. It's terrible. It really bothers me a lot. And if I was a client, it would bother me even more.
I'm amazed. I don't recall that you mentioned that in the book, that he still had the custody of those.
I don't recall whether it's mentioned in the book or not. I happen to have a copy, which I keep under my living room sofa. I know that always kills people. They do still have the originals. I don't know what they're planning on doing with them or where they keep them, but they're there.
Has anyone on the list ever contacted you in deadly fear in the middle of the night saying, where is the list? I cannot risk my name getting out.
Well, unfortunately, I have an unlisted number. After this whole thing broke, I started getting more bizarre calls than you could possibly imagine. But I have heard through friends, through other people. But most of them wishing me good luck. I think that I ran the business in such a way, and they all knew me for so long, they all realize that. No, the names are going to never get out because of me. Of course, all the clients would much prefer that I had the books as opposed to the authorities. I think that's a little ironic that they feel safer with me having them than the district attorney, but there's nothing that can be done about that.
The point that you make at the conclusion is that you think prostitution should be legalized.
I feel that it's I think it's yet another privacy issue. In front of the Supreme Court, within the last year, we've had a number of privacy. We've had Roe versus Wade. We've had the Georgia sodomy case. We've had a number of other things. I think this is just yet another personal privacy issue. I think what people do in the privacy of their own bedrooms, both consenting adults, really is not the business of the government, especially if no one's being hurt and everyone agrees, you know, that they like what's going on. And that's why I think it should be legalized. I don't think anyone has any business to tell any of us what we do in our own bedrooms and how we spend our money or how we make our money.
I suspect there are a lot of people who would enjoy your book, but who would still disagree with that position.
I'm sure they would, and I guess I'm pragmatic enough to realize that there are a lot of people out there who are never going to like me and who are never going to approve of me. But hey, that's the way it is, and there's just, you know, there's nothing I can do about that.
Isn't a big part of the attraction, though, for some men, perhaps, the fact that it is illegal, that they have to do it on the sly, that it is something that's a bit adventuresome. If they're an accountant by day and they or whatever they happen to do, and it's drudgery and they drive home. But one night a week, perhaps, or once a month, or even once a year, they get to do something a little furtive, a little illegal.
I don't think it's the illegality that they, I don't think they like the illegality at all. I think it must be terrifying to a man to call a number. He has no idea who's on the other end. He has no idea how discreet these people are going to be, how they keep their records. I think the thing that he might feel a little guilty about is basically just sort of having sex with somebody other than his partner, whether he's married or unmarried. I don't think any of them like the illegal part of it. I think they just like the variety part of it.
I think it's amazing that you could convince men to give the real names.
Oh, we had to. I was very, very conscious of the girl's safety. That's one of the reasons so many girls worked for me. If you registered in a hotel, you know, when you register in a hotel, you must present your credit card, identification, and that sort of thing. And we always checked with the hotel to make sure he was who he said he was, in what room he said he was in. We did the same thing with residential clients. My attitude was, I'm sending them real live human beings, and I'm going to know, you know, who I'm sending these girls to. I was very, very protective of them.
I read something. We got something in the mail today from one of our little news feature services that I found so fascinating because I just read your book. And that is that some of the, well, I guess for lack of better terms, common streetwalkers in New York now are dressing for success. They're carrying briefcases.
No, they're not carrying briefcases yet. That's going to be next.
The story we got today says now they are.
Now they are, because there was a report about 3 weeks ago that they were dressing for success, but that the hotel security people had said, well, even though they're in suits and they look nice, we still can tell they're working girls because they don't have briefcases. Well, all those girls must have read it, and now they all went out and bought briefcases.
The story we got today said that now the hotel security guards are suspicious.
Are going crazy.
Because who can tell anymore? A woman looks like a businesswoman who's on a business trip.
But she is a businesswoman, and she is on a business trip, and it's none of their darn business.
Sydney Biddle Barrows is 73 now. She's a self-employed business consultant and writer. Now, you can get Mayflower Madam by Sydney Biddle Barrows by tapping on the link in our show notes or by going to our website, heardeverything.com. We may earn an Amazon commission if you make a purchase. While you're at heardeverything.com, don't miss my 1998 interview with another woman who chose an unusual profession, almost kind of by accident, my 1998 conversation with Hollywood stunt woman, but also mob wife, Georgia Durante.
I really didn't know that this is what I was doing, but I was a wheel woman for the mob. They were in these places, robbing these places, and I was driving the getaway car, but I had no idea that's what they were doing.
And my interview with someone else who knows a bit about sex scandals, my 2011 conversation with Hustler publisher Larry Flint.
It's going to come as a surprise to realize all the sex scandals that we're witnessing in politics today existed 250 years ago.
And of course, we post new episodes of Now I've Heard Everything here every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and you can find us everywhere you listen to podcasts. And thank you so much for listening. Next time on Now I've Heard Everything, she grew up with a famous father and learned a lot from the man who thought himself a failure as a father. My 2006 interview with Richard Pryor's daughter, Rain Pryor.
Everyone's so related to him, and I think that's why people loved him, is that he was so truthful and so brought those people alive that you just wanted to laugh with him and hug him.
That's next time on Now I've Heard Everything. I'm Bill Thompson.